Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled Courthouse Steps Oral Argument, U.S. Aid versus Alliance for Open Society International, Inc. My name is Greg Walsh, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Casey Maddox, a Senior Fellow of Free Speech and Toleration at the Charles Koch Institute, and Crystal B. Swensbo, an Associate at Wiley Ryan LLP. After our speakers give their opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you all for sharing with us today. Mr. Maddox, the floor is yours.
Great. And thank you all for joining us. Hopefully you had an opportunity to listen in to the argument this morning. And if whether you did or did not, hopefully we can give you a little bit of a synopsis of what the court discussed this morning and how the argument went, and possibly where we think the court may go. But just to give a bit of an overview, we will begin with just a little bit of discussion about the procedure of the telephone argument. This is a new thing. We're only on the second day ever of these sorts of arguments, so we'll talk about that just briefly. Provide a quick background on the case for those, especially who don't know much about this case. We'll provide an explanation of how we got here and what's at issue. Then we'll talk some about the issues that the court discussed and the potential implications of the decision, and then we'll wrap up by taking any questions. So I guess just to begin, and Crystal, feel free to jump in here, but the court held telephonic argument, and just so everyone is aware of how that is working, instead of the normal process where justices can sort of jump in at any time and ask questions, the way the court is doing that for these telephonic arguments is to begin with the most senior justice, and they each ask one or two questions and sort of move through the court. So after the first few minutes where the attorney is beginning their presentation, then they quickly move to questions and move through the court basically just one or two at a time. So it's a very different dynamic than we've heard in other arguments. I think one of the downside of handling it this way is that it probably devalues the questions asked by the more junior justices because they can't come earlier on in the argument where they could sort of more shape the way the conversation is going. It's also very orderly, though. So it has that advantage. So,
well, Casey, I'll point out, I mean, Justice Thomas is known for being silent on the bench. He has asked questions for the last 2 days in a row, both to petitioners and respondents. So maybe the order is good for that part, but it does end up being a very different argument when you have the justices going in a more procedural order like this.
That's right. And I think you'll probably hear it when we get to the end. I think it makes it a lot more difficult to read tea leaves. Not that tea leaf reading is ever easy, but it seems a little more challenging to read tea leaves from the court coming out of an argument where it is that structured, because you don't know which justices are so passionate about one particular point that they keep coming back to it or something like that. So that can be a little more challenging. So Crystal, if you want to give a case summary.
Absolutely. Thank you, Casey. So fundamentally, this case is about the government's power to dictate speech by conditioning grant funding on the adoption of the government's anti-prostitution message. Speech requirement is part of the Leadership Act, which was originally passed in 2003, and has authorized over $80 billion to combat HIV, AIDS, and requires that no funds may be used by an organization, quote, that does not have a policy explicitly opposing prostitution, end quote. And that's the policy requirement that's really an issue here. So this is the second time this case has come before the court. 2013, the court ruled that the funding requirement violated the First Amendment, because it required the respondents, at that point, just domestic grant recipients, to pledge allegiance to the government's policy. The almost identical issue is presented to the court again today, with a slight twist. So the policy requirement was originally found unconstitutional as applied to respondents who were domestic organizations. The respondents this time, same entities that were before the court in 2013, but now we're talking about their closely related foreign affiliates. So it's domestic grant recipients that are large enough to have a foreign affiliate. Now, based on the record, the foreign affiliates are virtually indistinguishable from the domestic entities. They share branding, messages, they speak with one voice. Respondents argue that the 2013 decision effectively resolves the question here. Dictating the speech of their closely related foreign affiliates is the same as dictating speech for the domestic entities. It's unconstitutional, a violation of the First Amendment. Now, the government's argument draws a fine distinction based on corporate formalities of the domestic and foreign entities. And frankly, it flips the First Amendment argument on its head, asserting that there are no constitutional barriers or limits to dictating the speech of foreign entities, which I think puts us in a little bit of a different ground for First Amendment arguments. So, Casey, what do you think of the argument?
Well, you know, like I hinted at the beginning, I find it difficult to really gauge which way the court is going to go here. I think the change in makeup of the court may impact that, not having Justice Kennedy here. My sense is that this is, and we have Justice Kagan, as she did before, had recused. We probably should have mentioned that up front. So there's an eight-member court hearing this case. I think there is at least a decent possibility that the court splits or that they find some way to basically punt on an undeveloped record. So it was a very different conversation this time than the last time in that the government wasn't really asked to justify very much why it was imposing this, why it was necessary. The conversation was much more about basically whether rights were violated, whether the corporate form question, it was those kinds of conversations rather than what is the government's interest it's attempting to advance. That was not really part of the conversation at all.
I agree. Usually it seems like these First Amendment cases focus on the government's ability to do something. The government has to justify their standard or their policy. Here, the government really kind of came out of the gate in their brief and even an argument to say there's nothing to stop us, which I think is kind of a bold position for the government to take.
Yeah,
so, Casey, why do you think the government took this case? I say we had a strong opinion back in 2013. The Second Circuit here, you know, held that 2013 expanded a little bit. It expanded the 2013 opinion to apply to these foreign affiliates. So why are we looking at the case now?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, you generally assume that the court doesn't, you know, just take a case in order to affirm, and, you know, that you would make money betting that way. The court doesn't take money to affirm, doesn't take the court to affirm. And here, you know, if AOS wins, that's what the court has done. And so why take the case at all? Why not let the issue develop before taking this up? But it doesn't. It certainly did not seem from the argument that there was a strong sense that the court was trying to draw a line and was clearly leaning toward the government here. And so it didn't seem that you know, it was trying to rein in its prior decision, for example, here. So we may have to wait to find out why the court took the case and, you know, why not wait until let the Second Circuit's decision stand and take the next one. So I don't know. I don't have a good judgment, I guess, for how I expect the court will rule. Do you have a guess, Crystal?
I say I don't right offhand. I was a little surprised. I expected, you know, Justice Roberts wrote the prior opinion, so I expected him to come out of the gate a little bit stronger on the government burden side of this. I didn't hear those kind of questions, and then some of the hypotheticals posed were very tough. And it really, I think, put the onus on respondents, even though they had been successful in the lower court to justify why their First Amendment rights were being violated, which I think was a little surprising. So I may be a little biased here. I, you know, worked on one of the amicus briefs submitted here, and obviously not speaking for our client there. But I'd like to think that the court will affirm. But I'm curious in what way they will do it, and what, if any, lines they draw, or if this might ultimately be a cutback on their strong opinion from 2013.
Yeah, and you know, I think there was a lot of concern. At least a lot of questions, maybe I should say it that way, from the justices about the potential implications of a decision for AOS, what other government programs might be affected. And, you know, there were questions from Alito, from Kavanaugh, at least along those lines, you know, just sort of querying exactly where this would go. I didn't think that they got particularly strong answers on those questions. And they ranged everywhere from the Mexico City policy, which in some of this we can talk about a little bit later on, Mexico City policy, the foreign
finance
contributions, right, exactly, in U.S. elections. And then a lot of hypotheticals that were interesting hypotheticals about, What happens if you have grants to organizations internationally that are promoting peace in the Middle East and the U.S. government requires them to adopt a specific internal policy about their views on Israel, for example. Okay. And my sense was that those are very good questions with not particularly fine answers to sort of cabin a decision. I don't know if you had a different thought on that.
No, I think that's fair. And it might be worthwhile to talk a little bit about some of these hypotheticals in depth. So, for example, one of them I think was a really tough one to answer. I believe it was by Justice Alito talking about, Justice Kavanaugh talked about what if we had a policy that required the recognition of Israel in funding peacekeeping efforts in the Middle East. Would that particular requirement be acceptable? And obviously, Respondents' Counsel answered it, this is kind of nearing the end of the argument, noted that there's a difference between a fact that is required to be spoken and then something like the policy requirement here that's more of a belief. And it was a kind of a quick answer, and I think it fulfilled the question. But it obviously raises additional concerns. We had NIFLA versus Becerra that talked about compelled speech for facts. That was obviously a problem. So I think these hypotheticals raised kind of bigger issues that we didn't get the opportunity to dive into during the argument. And because the justices weren't able to kind of pile on each other's questions or ask follow-ups, I don't think we got the really in-depth answers that Respondents' Counsel was prepared for or that might actually be illuminating on these issues.
No, that's right. So, on that particular question, there wasn't then the opportunity for a justice, as you would have expected, basically, if the arguments were in the court, to have immediately said, but what about NIFLA? Didn't we say? And then have a back and forth and hopefully get to a more refined answer on the question. So you're sort of left with this, it's because it's that would be a factual argument rather than, or even the opportunity for a justice to clarify, okay, well, let me fix my hypothetical for you. That's a little more challenging to do in this context with a much more structured argument. I'll walk through just quickly some of the main kind of strands of First Amendment jurisprudence that are at issue. I think there are at least a couple that are really presented here that are going to weigh on this decision, the compelled speech cases and the unconstitutional conditions cases, and sometimes those overlap. But the compelled speech cases, obviously going back to cases like West Virginia versus Barnett, where the Supreme Court had held that the government couldn't force Jehovah's Witnesses to salute the flag. So you have that case, Woolley versus Maynard, where New Hampshire had tried to have the live free or die on every license plate and was not going to make an exception again for Jehovah's Witness in that case. Hurley versus Gay, Lesbian, Irish Americans of Boston, where the government was applying a non-discrimination rule to try to require a parade organizer to allow people in who were going to be representing a message that they didn't want to have in their parade, a group of gay and lesbian individuals who wanted to march in the St. Patrick's Day parade with them. NIFLA case that we mentioned, where the pregnancy centers in California were being required to provide certain disclosures, some of which would have been arguably just factual information, but they had objections to doing that. And the Supreme Court held that those were protected free speech rights against compelled speech in those contexts. And in the Hurley case, it has not been mentioned here, but seems to me quite relevant Healy was, if you go back just a little bit, the early 1970s, universities, Central Connecticut State had decided that it would not recognize a student organization because of that student organization's association with a national student organization that had allegedly engaged in violent activities. And so the university wanted this student group to sign a pledge that it did not support the use of violence. And the group said basically, well, we don't use violence, but we will not sign a pledge of support in that way and engage in that compelled speech. The case was decided as a freedom of association case, but it's often thought of as a compelled speech case and frankly looks a lot like the facts here, at least with the domestic organizations that had come before. The unconstitutional conditions cases obviously are, government can't do indirectly by withholding government benefits or privileges, usually what it can't do directly. And those are cases like Keishian versus Board of Regents, where you have a faculty member. The state of New York was requiring all faculty members to pledged that they were not a member of the Communist Party or never had been a member of the Communist Party. And so that personal pledge requirement, again, that sounds a little like the situation here in 2013, at least with the prior version of the case. The political patronage cases all through O'Hare Truck Service, which is one of my favorite interesting First Amendment cases where the court had held, even where the benefit at issue is something you have absolutely no right to. So in that case, it was sort of a rotation for towing companies who wanted to be able to do towing for a community in Illinois. And the Supreme Court held that even there, the government couldn't take people out of the towing rotation on the basis of protected activity. In that case, the O'Hare Truck Service, the owner of O'Hare Truck Service had supported the mayor's opponent, political opponent in an election, that violated the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. The sort of exception to all of this, or the kind of offshoot of these cases, are the government speech cases like Rust versus Sullivan, where the government is providing funding for a private entity to speak the government's own message and can thus require them to say something or refrain from saying something as a condition of the grant. And Rust is the what's often thought of as the gag rule case, the abortion gag rule case, where entities were not permitted to provide abortion referrals in that case. And that was deemed permissible because it was as part of the grant program. So that's kind of the history of the cases that are leading up to the situation here.
One thing I found interesting, and I think is a recurring theme in the cases that you mentioned, is what's the injury here? We've talked a lot about you can't be forced to say something. The government shouldn't be allowed to compel you to say something or to put words in your mouth. There's also the potential injury of your speech being chilled. There's a limitation or a punishment imposed for speaking in a certain way. But I think, and both of those were brought up during the argument today, but there's a kind of a third category of injuries that I thought might play in here more than it actually was talked about during the argument. And that's the right to avoid having to rebut the government's point. So it's not, yeah. I think the government here has made the argument, it doesn't matter if we impose our regulations on the foreign affiliates. Domestic entities, you can just clarify any confusion. There's no issue. You just have to say, no, we disagree, because you have the freedom to say what you want. But public confusion regarding who the speaker is isn't really kind of the main issue. It's really a point that if the government's policy was allowed to stand here, the domestic entities effectively are required to rebut or to correct what is being said. They're having to kind of stand up and correct the record. They're having to overcome the government's thumb on the scale, as it were. And so I think that's a unique area of injury that I didn't see talked about a lot, but it was definitely kind of running through the NIFLA decision we've talked about. An American Beverage versus San Francisco out of the Ninth Circuit en banc talked about this as well. It's not necessarily that you will solely be chilled from speaking further, but that you shouldn't be forced to say something, including a correction for the government's misstatement or a way to counteract the government's forced speech.
And that, I think that's a good segue to talk about some of the kind of issues that have been bubbling inside this case. There was a line from the 2013 decision that was concerned about the government's mandate there requiring the domestic organization to have to engage in evident hypocrisy with the line. You want to talk a little bit about that, Crystal, and how you think that plays today?
Sure. So the origin of this line came from questioning by Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kennedy back in 2013. In that case, the government forced, effectively, the argument goes, it's evident hypocrisy to force contrasting hypocritical messages from one side of an organization, but allow the other side to speak freely. The line received heavy, and this line was again restated in the court's 2013 opinion. Basically, the idea is if you have a free-speaking side of the organization and a hampered side of the organization, it effectively undermines the entire message because you can't speak out of both sides of your mouth. Now, this line received heavy attention from the court today. Justice Breyer kind of noted that nothing has really changed since the line was written in 2013. Justice Ginsburg, again, revisited it. Respondents' counsel, I think, nicely summarized why this evident hypocrisy is a problem. And it sounds terrible, but there's obviously kind of a practical problem as well. Imposing a speech requirement on only part of an organization is just as bad as imposing it on the whole organization, because the requirement undermines the credibility and integrity of the entire organization's message, which particularly here where we're dealing with HIV/AIDS, it's important to have that kind of trust from the local community and to work with individuals to make sure that if you can serve this end properly. If folks in the local community don't trust the speaker or don't trust an organization because, hey, out of one side of their mouths, they say, we don't support prostitution. The other side, they have to work with individuals who have been in the prostitution industry, or you have to kind of work within a government structure. You want to make sure your message is consistent and that you can be trusted and that the aid you give will be trusted. And frankly, the evident hypocrisy the government is requiring here undermines that power.
The case that I did not mention earlier, that I usually will mention in these contexts, and I'll mention now, that I think is interesting in light of the evident hypocrisy concern, is the Christian Legal Society versus Martinez case. That's a case that is a compelled speech, compelled association, religious freedom. It's a kind of a combination case, an unconstitutional conditions case. It's basically the case where the Supreme Court held 5-4 when we were a few justices different than we are now on the court, that it was permissible for the University of California, Hastings, to have what was called an all-comers policy, and a policy that required every student organization to adopt a policy that it would not discriminate on the basis of, among other things, religion and sexual orientation. In its non-discrimination policy, but they interpreted that policy in an all-comers sense to mean that basically every organization had to agree to allow everyone to stand for office. And so that was the issue that came before the court, and the court upheld that 5-4. It's a similar kind of, you must adopt, it's not so much we require you to say these words out loud, but we require you to change the internal documents for your organization in a way that reflects the policy that the school wants reflected. And the evident hypocrisy point there to me comes in where the concurrence from Justice Kennedy says that, well, if the organization is actually taken over, then the organization can come back and sue and challenge the fact that it is no longer allowed, or that it has been taken over by outsiders who disagree with the organization, and that the court could look at that at that point. But that, again, seems to create this hypocritical situation where the organization, in order to sue later, would have had to already adopt a policy now saying that it has a policy that it would later say that it disavowed. And so that
very much a catch-22.
Yeah, it's this sort of odd situation where a private entity is placed in a position like that, where it has to say words that it doesn't really mean, and is basically then put on the hook to try to have to explain to other people, what it means and why it doesn't actually agree with the government, even though it adopted the government's preferred message in its internal documents.
I found it interesting, this evident hypocrisy line coming up, again, for the very reasons you pointed out for CLSC Martinez. It signals kind of I think Justice Sotomayor referred to it during the argument. This is much more of a functional approach to First Amendment speech regulations. You don't really see this anywhere else in the law. And Justice Sotomayor kind of listed a number of cases, Hobby Lobby, Hurley, a couple of others, to note that the First Amendment is less concerned with kind of a formality or even a corporate formality in this case, so much as it is concerned with imputation or affiliation. What did you think of that argument and that strain of questions in the argument today?
Well, the most interesting part of that to me was just how much it signaled how the First Amendment doesn't care about your politics. And basically the way First Amendment doctrine works when it's working properly is that it should be protecting neutral principles. And so, today we heard counsel for Alliance for an Open Society, which is a George Soros organization, citing Citizens United favorably. We heard Masterpiece Cake Shop, We heard Justice Sotomayor pointing to Hobby Lobby and Hurley. So, you know, that's all very healthy. It's, you know, the First Amendment should be applying and protecting things. If it's not protecting speech that you don't like, then, you know, if you're not able to cite the First Amendment in support of speech that you don't like, then you may not have a very well-developed understanding of what the First Amendment is supposed to do. So I think that was all very positive, but it is very interesting to, you know, to see how these principles end up working in, you know, in ways that are, you know, protecting the speech of, you know, more than one side of the political calculus. I think the, to your question about the, you know, the attribution test, I think there were concerns from both Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas about exactly what this would look like. How do we know that an entity is in fact, you know, closely associated, mm-hmm. and is that the right test? You know, these are legally separate entities, and you know, what is the line going to be in future cases, or potentially, what are the facts that they cite in this case to be able to show that, you know, here the speech of the domestic organizations be affected by the international affiliates adopting this policy because of public perception, because of co-branding? You know, what exactly are those factors?
You're right. And Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas kind of went into this in some detail, which I think this might go to your earlier point. We're not sure what the court will do with this case. This case has been going on for 15 years. So there's been a lot of back and forth, and the government, you know, obviously sought discovery from the respondents on this point. Respondents have a pretty sizable appendix of affidavits and testimony talking about how the organizations are similar and how their messaging is similar. But it's interesting that we haven't really seen a test develop. Obviously, Respondents' Council talked about it a bit during argument today, but a real test hasn't kind of come up. And it seems interesting to have a test be developed without the government really going into the interest that's compelling a test or that would allow them to limit speech in the way that they're doing here.
Crystal, I think we've already hit some on some of the long-term consequences. Do you want to touch on that, or should we head over to questions? Or
I have one question.
Okay.
Sure. Well, I'm going to kind of kick it back to you a little bit. So there were two policies you mentioned up front, the Mexico City policy, and then the campaign finance bar. I want to get your thoughts, particularly on those two, just because I think campaign finance is, a difficult question. And frankly, it was a hard question when it was raised today. The Mexico City policy, I think, is kind of front and center of a lot of people's minds and thinking how this case will apply going forward.
Yeah, and I think the answer, at least on the Mexico City policy, is you know, basically the two ways that this has been distinguished from Mexico City, both in the Second Circuit below, and I think in some of the arguments we've seen, well, reading between the tea leaves and some of the questioning today, was distinction here. The argument they're making here is that this is affecting the domestic organizations, not the international affiliates, mm-hmm. but the domestic organizations' free speech rights. Because of their close association. That seems to me to be largely not the case in the Mexico City policy context. There may be circumstances where it is. The other big distinction with the Mexico City policy and the one distinction that I heard today on the campaign finance bar on foreign contributions is the distinction between a restriction on speech for a grantee and compelled speech. There are the Supreme Court has said, at least, you know, in passing before, that compelled speech is, you know, particularly bad. And what I don't think we actually have from the court is a clear holding that, you know, much like viewpoint discrimination is even worse than content discrimination. Both may be bad, but viewpoint is really, really bad. What we haven't heard is the Supreme Court say, and compelled speech is worse than a speech restriction in a way that we will recognize a clear constitutional difference, where if this had been merely a speech restriction, it would have been okay, and the government would have been, there would have been no violation here. But because it is compelled speech, it's a different thing. That may end up being one of the possible implications of this case. If so, it will be quite significant. I think it's been, like I said, it's been sort of hiding in some of these, and the NIFLA case even, that's particularly concerning, the idea that pregnancy centers would not only be prohibited from saying a particular thing, but would actually have to affirmatively state the government's message. I'll let you have other thoughts on how this case may affect those issues.
No, I think you've kind of summarized it. And I know folks, if they have questions, we'll get to those in just a moment. I do think your point about the distinction between compelled speech and then speech restrictions may make the difference for this campaign finance hypothetical. I think that may be not an easy way, but it could be a clean way for the court to address that and hopefully cabin its opinion to the extent it needs to on that front.
We'll now go to the first question. Once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question. Casey, Crystal, it doesn't look like we have anybody in the queue. Do you want to go into a little bit more depth on what you were talking about at the end there?
Hey, I would say we can certainly talk a little bit more about the hypotheticals. And I don't know, Casey, I've had, as I noted, we've written a brief for this case, and my firm has been involved in these First Amendment issues for a long time. So it's always been interesting to see what type of policies the government uses or tries to use its funding power for. So I think my favorite one, even more recently, there was one state attempted to prohibit boycotting the state of Israel as a condition of public employment, required contractors to cease and refrain from engaging in constitutionally protected speech. This is out of the Western District of Texas in 2019. So to the extent there's any thought that, allowing the government to use their spending power in this way will not have a large effect, I think there are constantly cases coming up where states and other government entities are using their funding in a way so they can dictate the marketplace of ideas. And this case, I think, kind of opens the door for more of that.
Yeah, I think in terms of other possible implications here, I mean, even for commercial speech issues, where you have a lesser, First Amendment standard that's applicable, if the court decides this case in a way that essentially treats compelled speech as different than speech restrictions and more pernicious than a speech restriction, then that could potentially have implications for some of those cases, or at least those would be opportunities for further development if that was the case, because at least some of the compelled speech disclosure requirements, even in the commercial context, might be kind of newly questionable, I guess, at that point. But yeah, I mean, I philosophically to me, it makes sense. I think you can't sort of cabin once you are required to say something, especially a statement of opinion. If you're required to say something, there's kind of no putting the genie back in the bottle. A speech restriction that says, particularly you can't say this in this context because you're receiving this funding for this period of time or something like that. I think there is a difference in character between being limited with what your entity can say, and, which is a right you can nevertheless exercise at another time in another way, and a compelled speech, which, once you have uttered words, you are on record with, having taken a position, it's arguably more difficult to sort of backtrack on that.
Very much so. It changes the content. It's very much a content-based restriction, as the court previously found.
Right.
Casey, Crystal, I don't see any questions in the queue.
Well, clearly we've answered them all, so that's great.
Glad we could be so helpful.
Okay, we have one. Yeah, you guys went into so much depth. I think you covered all the bases. Caller from area code 631, you're on the line.
Hi. I just wanted to have maybe the guest speakers touched on the issue with the pandemic and the squelching of free speech and possibly even elections. Do they have any comment on maybe the bevy of court cases that may make it up to the Supreme Court?
That's a good question. I did a thing for the RNLA a couple of weeks ago on this front. I think, I think the way those cases are most likely to present, if we get a speech case up to the court, is probably going to be not a sort of a kind of facial attack on the government's ability to restrain, public gatherings, church services, that kind of thing, in light of coronavirus, but it's going to be more like a discriminatory application of those, or at least allegations to that effect, right? So either where, similar activities are being permitted and government is not permitting church meetings or protest activity or something like that to go forward along the same lines. You know, I think there are some open legal questions right now around, you know, if you can, you know, gather, or if you can stand in line at a Home Depot, if you can stand in line, you know, or, you know, be inside of a grocery store, then why can't other activities that are constitutionally protected have the same kind of requirements put in place? So kind of the overbreadth of some of these policies, I think, may be an issue. I think the challenge, frankly, to getting one of those cases up there is that by the time we get to the Supreme Court on many of these questions, at least I am hopeful that the issue would have been mooted by then. But I guess we'll see. Crystal, if you had a different
thought. Looks like we have another caller.
No, I agree. I think that makes sense. Go ahead.
Area code 475, you're on the line.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for the opportunity. A great conversation on all the topics there. What do you think is going to happen if you had the crystal ball in terms of how the Supreme Court may rule on some of these controversial things, specifically around, you know, from civil liberties in a state of this sort of national or international, actually, health crisis, you know, in that sort of format. And maybe this is a loaded question here, but just kind of trying to pick your brain on this based on all your experience and what you've seen in the past maybe decade or two. Thanks.
Crystal, do you have thoughts on kind of what cases you expect to get there?
I'll
say that the thing that I've heard from people kind of concerned is that, especially with and frankly, I think largely people have avoided bringing a lot of these cases, but the more facial attack on you know, religious gatherings, that kind of thing, for example, maybe the case that sort of it makes it that those may be bad facts making bad law. If you're a First Amendment advocate, and particularly for someone who's concerned about a decision like Employment Diversion Division versus Smith, that the better case are sort of the more discriminatory application of those rather than, you know, kind of the broadside challenge. But I don't know, Crystal, have you got thoughts on kind of where you're getting engaged here?
So, I mean, I anticipate we could get any number of different things coming up, but I think the most obvious one is the discrimination effects of these in the religious freedom category. I mean, we've seen a couple of cases like that bubbling up in the Sixth Circuit. And one thing I think kind of it may come up, you know, no matter what the vehicle, but this idea here, the government has a lot of kind of a lot of power, a lot of trust to be doing what it is doing because, you know, we've got a pandemic. It's one of the odd times in life we get to justify a lot of things on the basis of a pandemic. And the government will be given a lot more freedom, I think, to do what it wants and to pose regulations that otherwise would not be acceptable. So here, I think if and when it comes up to the court, the question will we still continue to put the government through its paces for imposing regulations that violate the, you know, our fundamental freedoms? Or will we allow the government a bit more flexibility because we are scared of a pandemic? Will we allow the government to, you know, impose limitations on our speech or require us to say certain things? Or, you know, prevent us from going to worship in any number of ways in a way that the government has never been allowed to do that before without question. And so I think it's kind of an approach, perhaps more so than a specific case I've got in mind.
Yeah. And I think regardless of what courts end up doing with these cases, I think this has been a good illustration that we've seen play out recently that this is not necessarily a conflict between government having the power to do what it needs to do to address the pandemic and government respecting civil liberties. What exactly civil liberties may look like in a pandemic may vary a bit, but I think the challenge that we've been seeing and a lot of the reason that people have been protesting and upset and it has basically been because they are seeing examples where it appears that government is not respecting its own limits. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to say that the other way, I guess, if the more that government seems to be taking seriously the extraordinary powers that it is exercising right now. And you know, basically trying to prohibit as little as possible and not overreach. And I think people have a lot, as Crystal said, people have a lot of understanding for what is necessary in the moment. But the more that it looks like, government officials are overreaching and stepping over separation of powers and taking on authority that they maybe should not have, then it breaks down that public confidence with elected officials that makes it impossible for them to actually impose what needs to be imposed in order to address the crisis. So I think, contrary to the way that people would normally think about this, respecting civil liberties to the greatest extent possible may be exactly what government needs to do in order to have the public trust that it needs, to address the pandemic. One example of that is just the drive-in churches, right, that have largely won in those cases. And those are great illustrations where it's difficult for people to understand why it is the government would need to impose that. And so I think that causes, when you see governments, prohibiting that kind of innovation, it makes people lose confidence that the government is only imposing what's necessary. And that kind of lack of trust is I think particularly dangerous at a time like this when government's going to need to exercise more power than it normally does.
You also see, Casey, when you think about the voting cases, you've got a number of elections that have been put off sometimes the night before, or requests to put off elections the night before. This kind of quick fly by the seat of your pants acting, again, undermines that trust that you place in the government. You would hope that they'd utilize at a time like this.
Looks like we have a call from area code 631 again.
Maybe just as a follow-up, touch on, for example, the so-called nationwide injunction on immigration restrictions, where one circuit judge is able to basically create a nationwide injunction. Why do you think that hasn't been done with this seemingly overreaching power? And also, as far as a standard of proof for this type of situation where the government grabs that much power and just shuts the entire economy down, shouldn't the courts be the arbiter of that as opposed to just executives that just, running over each other to kind of just shut things down? And third and lastly, where do you think this will wind up as far as the power of the executive unchallenged by the courts? Or the legislature, for that matter, because I don't think there's any legislature as far as a pandemic goes, other than local police power. How are they able to lock away healthy people to save sick people when there really is no scientific proof that healthy people can spread it? I understand they said that there's these asymptomatic spreading going on, but there is no objective proof of that. Wouldn't it be better served in the court as, for example, using a TRO or something of that nature to grant that power? And then if the court finds that the standard of proof or evidence makes sense, then to continue the power of the executive to continue. And with that, I'll yield back and listen.
Well, I'll attempt to address a couple of those points just quickly. I think on the nationwide injunction issue, that the distinction here is that despite a lot of the way this has been maybe talked about in some quarters, I mean, these are largely state and local governments that are acting, or generally state governments that are imposing most of the restrictions here. And so a nationwide injunction wouldn't quite work because those are normally come in the context where there is one actor who has done something and it's, being enjoined in one particular district, but for the entire country, the application of that, like in the immigration context. As to, I think on the kind of separation of powers related question, there was also interestingly, I think the first problem, there is that, basically for most states, at least everyone that I'm aware of, you know, there is some sort of statute in place that gives the executive, you know, the whatever power they have in this context. So I think that's why you're seeing it come from executives, because legislatures have largely, you know, given them that power. Now, whether they are staying within those confines is a whole other question. There was an oral argument I would recommend to you this morning, because it's very informative, an actual video of the oral argument in Wisconsin, where the legislature had sued the governor, or actually the Secretary of Health, over her kind of asserted, you know, broad power to issue mandates without oversight by the legislature or engagement by the legislature. So would recommend looking at that. But that's an example, I think, of, you know, the where the courts will get engaged, but basically to police the, you know, the relation, the separation of powers between the legislature and the governor, and what powers the legislature actually has given the governor or the secretary in this case, and whether the whether they're overstepping that authority. So I think that's the right, you know, the right place for this to be. It should ultimately be, you know, there should be a check and balance operating here, and it seems to be playing out in Wisconsin.
Casey, Crystal, do you have anything to add or conclude on before we finish up?
Other than it'll be a very interesting opinion when it comes out, and we look forward to it. And thank you for hosting.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'll be very interested to see if we actually get this opinion by the end of June. I guess that's maybe the other open question, is whether with arguments being pushed later, whether June 30 end of the court deadline actually sticks this year, but I guess we'll find out.
That's an interesting thought. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.